Not many. Just a reminder that the assignment is due on Friday. I have been answering questions, posting both Facebook and on the class website. I just add them to the file, or does that make sense? I add them to the like the blog entry. I just add more questions to it. So I'm not sure if people have kind of set up alerts for the blog to have it send you when I have a new post. It might not be fully alerting you because I'm editing an old post or something. Anyways, just in case you have any questions, you can check there before you email me. Any questions now? Does it feel good? Yes, Tabitha.
I have a question about Monday's class assignment. Okay. No elaboration needed. Is it
going to
be open book?
Yes.
What's the format?
You mean you think I've written it already?
So the assignments in class are always open book. You can bring your computer if you want to for, I don't know, you miss it or something, but like it will be some type of group work as well. The reason I haven't written it yet is I have to kind of actually do some math and figure out what's the. There's like 66 people mostly in the room, or hopefully showing up. I will give you all the assignments you need to prepare for it. You should simply prepare by making sure you have done all the reading and understand all those concepts that we've covered. If there's something in there that you've been like, I read it, but I didn't understand it, that would be a good thing to come to my office hours and chat with me about, stuff like that. Yeah?
That's true, generally for the in-class assignments. I'm not expecting you to do any. If I ever want you to do any prep work beforehand, I will make that very clear. But for the most case now, it's kind of nice in some ways. You don't have extra reading. You can just kind of wander in that day. And I look at all of the assignments as well as learning experiences, not just trying to test what you, not just me seeing what you've learned already, but hopefully as a vehicle for you to learn more while you talk with others and complete them. Other questions that I want to answer? Anyone else got some? All right, awesome. Let's review slightly. So we started talking about, we finished up our adverse possession last time and started talking about kind of these chattels, these found property. And we're going to continue on that today. And we'll see very quickly that these categories that we put them into, this lost, mislaid, abandoned, treasure trove, it makes a big difference for who actually can gain title to the property, what kind of category it falls under. So we'll look at a couple more examples. So let's start with, let's go back to our reading from last time, and we'll start with this Hannah B. Peel case. Jamie, can you help us with this one? All right.
So the plaintiff, who was the sole real estate, basically stayed in the house of the defendant owned the house, but didn't occupy the house physically. And the plaintiff found a brooch. And he...
Where did he find it? I love that two of you have done like the same hand motion of where it was found. Both Andy and Arthur are like doing this like type of thing.
It was on the top of a window frame.
Yeah, this is important, right? We will see as we're doing kind of our lost and found property that the and abandoned, that the circumstances of where the thing is found, where the item is actually changes our analysis. It's an important fact. We're thinking about kind of trying to think out the operative fact. Of a case, the circumstances of the object itself are pretty important. All right, so found on top of a windowsill. Any other information we have about the brooch when it was found? What it was like? What it looks like? When it was found?
It was covered with cobwebs and dirt, so it didn't. I guess it didn't look like it was anything that would be particularly valuable.
Ooh. Yeah, anything else that it might tell us that it's about it being covered with cobwebs and dirt? Any other thing that might indicate?
I guess it's old.
Yeah, or at least that it's been there a while. all of this is supposition. I mean, maybe it was dirty when somebody put it up there, but these are kind of, this is like the types of things we have to inquire about, these objects we're trying to figure out who owns them. All of these things matter. Like, okay, it was kind of covered in cobwebs and dirty, suggesting maybe it had been there for a while. Okay, all right, so what happens? So what does Hannah, finds this brooch, the soldier finds this brooch on top of the windowsill. What does he do with it?
He gives it to the police.
All right. And then does the original owner come forward to claim it?
No.
All right, so then what do the police do?
The police give it back to him. And
No, who do the police give it to?
To the defendant.
They give it to Peel. They give it to the landowner, the person who owns the house. Okay, and did Peel give it back to Hannah? What happens next?
No, so the defendant sold it, and then to Messrs. Spinkle and Son, and then those people resold it the next month.
All right, and so what is Hannah suing for then? Is this going to be a Replevin or a Trover case?
Yes. Replevin.
What's the difference? Which is which? If you're suing in Replevin, what are you asking for?
The actual chattel back.
Right. So do you think it's more likely he wants the brooch back or that he wants the money?
Probably the value of it.
The value. So this is good. This is, we could just see, even if it didn't say in here, he's going to ask for the value, particularly if you have an object that's been sold and moved on. Notice he is not suing the person who actually has the brooch, right? So it's going to be, he can't really get kind of, he can't sue in Replevin against somebody who doesn't have the object in his hands. So he's going to be suing for Trover. Okay. All right. So based on what we have learned so far, and our remember our little our little chimney sweep there, based on Armory versus DeLaramie, who should have title to this brooch? And we just went up based on the rule we learned from that case. We'll start with this. What is the rule? What is the rule we learned last time from the Armory case?
The person who finds it has a superior title to everyone other than the owner, the true owner.
Okay, all right. So if that is our rule, that the person who finds it, we're all going to agree that it is the soldier who finds it, has true title against everyone but the true owner or prior possessor. Who should get this?
Hannah should get it.
The soldier, right? Hannah should get it based on that. All right. Is there any argument, even under the Armory rule, that we should give it to Peel, to the homeowner? Can you think of one? Any way we could...
Yeah. If he's the true owner.
If he's the true owner, that would make sense. Now, he's not... He never actually... He inherited this house, but he never got to move in. Should that make a difference, the fact that he never lived there? Is that a maybe, or is that you want to elaborate?
Well, I mean, it might affect whether he had possession of it, or whether, I guess.
So one way to kind of think about it is whether or not he kind of had constructive possession. So if we think about it, is if Armory is being, the first finder gets it, I guess unless there's a prior possessor with a better claim, we might think, well, maybe there's a good argument to say that he was kind of like a prior possessor. Let's say he has constructive possession because his owner of the house kind of owned it. That would be one argument that we could make. Now, the court does not like that argument, mostly because he never lived in the house. Why didn't he live there, Jamie? Do you know why he never moved in?
No, I'm not.
Charlotte?
The home was requisitioned by the military for use.
Right? So this happened a lot, right? The people's homes were requisitioned. They were used by the government to house soldiers and other things like that. So does it matter to us that that the government is the one who prevented him from moving into his home? Charlotte?
He had been paid to some fiddly degree for use of his home, or at least made, if things were damaged or something,
not necessarily. But would that matter for our question? Whether or not he... So let's say they did pay him rent of like $100 a month or something. Would that matter for our question about whether or not he should own the brooch?
I don't think that necessarily affects his own approach. I think his presence in the home having occupied the
right
home affects his ownership plan.
So the only way we can find, so this, I actually think canopy appeal is one of our like deceptively complicated cases, because we generally would think of the owner of a piece of property. We'll see this, that we see this discussion within the case about the owner of the locus in quo, right? Is that you usually own the stuff that's in your house. I mean, think how unusual this would be to you. If you have somebody who is not your renter, but somebody who's coming by and staying in your house and finds something, do they get to keep that thing? Right? Let's just think if it was your house. Let's say it's your house. You bought it, or you not even bought it, right? He inherited this, right? He inherited this house from, like, his uncle, or I don't know exactly, his dad, his uncle, whatever. He inherits this house, and you come over, and so you've inherited a house. Somebody comes over to your house and finds the brooch up in the windowsill. Do they get to keep it? What do you think? Should they get it because you didn't know it was there? They found it. Does anyone think that it makes sense for that person to keep the brooch? Yeah, Jav, I think you do?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, we can all say, you know, oh, this is a hypothetical, but, you know, if you actually were in a situation, I think you would be thoroughly annoyed. Especially say, okay, just to add another hypothetical, that brooch turns out to be a family heirloom that has some really great significance. Then you're sort of interfering with the personhood that the...
Absolutely, right? This is what, right? So think about this. This is a house that was in his family that he inherited. He did not get to occupy this house because the government requisitioned it. He had full intention of occupying it, but it was requisitioned before he could do so. A soldier, somebody who he already did not, like, kind of willingly give, I mean, maybe he was not... Maybe he was all behind the war effort and was happy to give up his home. But the soldier finds the stone. Now, if we think about that stone, who's the most likely true owner? Well, house was in his family. It could be a family heirloom, or it could at least be. It is more likely that it belonged to somebody in his family than not. And so, in some ways, I think we have a lot of sympathy with this soldier who finds a brooch. But at the same time, I think we should be able to see Peel's side of this story. Somebody finds a valuable object in his home. The only reason he didn't get to be in that home and find it for himself first is because the government took the home away from him temporarily. So we can see just from the facts of the case, we have kind of two sympathetic parties here. All right, but Jamie, how does the court make its determination? Does it just cite Armory and say first finder goes to Hannah?
No, so it goes through two different, I guess, rules of law that they could adopt for this case. The first one being, or the second one being that if a person finds an object while employed by the property owner, then that property owner gets the chattel, like whatever he finds, so gets an interest in whatever is found, so long as the property owner exercises control over that property.
Okay.
Which is not established in this case.
All right, so... Before we get to the next one, where are these rules coming from? Is he citing a statute? Is he bringing out treatises? Is this case law? Where is this court kind of, what is it looking for as its basis?
It's case law.
Case law. Now, this is a little bit different. Some of the other cases we've been reading in this have kind of called upon general principles of properties and ideas of ownership and rule of capture. Right? He is not citing law professors. He's not citing philosophers. He's going through a bunch of different case law and trying to reconcile it. All right, so the first is this idea that if the finder is an employee of the owner, of the landowner, then that finder is the landowner's agent, and anything they find is belongs to the owner. Does that apply in this case? Does that help us?
No, it doesn't apply here. Because of the fact that the defendant never actually occupied the house, so therefore he doesn't have a definite right of ownership in anything that's found in the house.
Yeah, so here's a picture of the house, and there's just no way to really characterize this soldier living in his house as his employee. It doesn't make sense. That doesn't get us any further. All right, you said there was another kind of strain of law that it looked at.
Yeah, so it's another case. Which means that the person who, well, it says that the person who found the chattel, they have the superior right of possession, which is applicable in this case.
All right, so that's the armory standard. Right, there's one more kind of line of cases that they consider here, and it comes from the two that they mention are South Staffordshire, Staffordshire, and Elwes. You see those? Christian, you see those?
I don't think they talk about whether it's found in a public place or not.
So, all right, so whether it's found in a public place, but I think here we have... the idea that it's not public, so they kind of dismiss that. There's one more that is actually kind of interesting here.
Kevin? Yeah, is it the rule that possession of the land carries with it possession of everything that's attached to it?
Yes.
In the absence of a better title elsewhere, and it's something about that, like whether or not they know it, it's still under their possession.
Right, so there's this idea of things that are attached to the land, or also they talk about the term embedded in the land. So we, and they say, okay, we have this rule, if things are attached, and they have this great case that is like, there's two of them I really like. One is this story about this, that they, the South Staffordshire one that they cite, that they hire some people to, the landowner hires some people to kind of dredge out the lake, and in doing so, they find some rings at the bottom of the lake. And who owned those? And you can see that that case then became both an employee case because he hired the people to clean out the lake. But it also had to do a little bit with the fact that the rings themselves were in the mud underneath it. And they said, okay, that's like attached to the land. It's like part of the land. You are the landowner, so you get it. It's part of the land. The one I also like even a little bit more, though, is the people who found a boat under their land. That didn't stand out to you. They talk about this case. In Elwes, there was a boat that was embedded in the soil. And the landowner had no idea that there was a boat in his backyard, buried in his backyard. And the boat, whether regarded as a mineral or as part of the soil in which it was embedded when discovered as a chattel, did not pass the landowner because it is something kind of so inherent and embedded in the land. All right, so now with that line of cases, Jamie, how does that help us with the brooch at all? Can we think of that brooch as being like attached or embedded in the house?
I don't think so.
But we do get one of the things that this case helps us with is not just a holding in this case, but it gives us a couple other little rules that might be helpful for other circumstances. Like, we need to think about whether things were found by employees. We need to think about whether or not things feel like really attached or embedded in the land. Those are going to be something. All right, the court says these aren't very helpful. Okay, so the court goes through these cases, and how does it rule in the end?
So it determines that the plaintiff has a superior interest in the brooch, and they consider the brooch as to be lost, and that he was the finder, and that by him actually, instead of just keeping it, but by him taking it to the police so that it may be returned to the rightful owner, his actions were actually commendable, and that he should get.
He's a good guy.
Do you feel like that the cases that the court cites, the court kind of walks us through some of these case laws to try and reconcile kind of the law of lost and found property, are logically lead you to this answer? Are they helpful in getting to the answer, showing you that clearly Hannah should win?
In a way they do, in a way they don't. I feel like they do because they go through cases that distinguish the current case from those. Like, for example, the brooch wasn't embedded in the property, and the defendant wasn't employed by, I'm sorry, the plaintiff wasn't employed by the defendant. And so, in that sense, I think it does.
So in one sense, it's helpful because it's like, let's go through all the prior case law we have about lost and found objects, and we'll show that none of them are similar to this. So we can't find any, maybe this, maybe I'm being a little generous to the court, but this is probably what they could have kind of said in summary. None of these cases are that helpful because none of them are circumstances like ours, so we need to kind of think about them as guiding rules, but none of them are binding upon us. But why is it not, why did you say in a way it's not helpful?
I mean, it's always better to have a case that's on point.
That what the court does here that I find very frustrating is the court goes through these cases, describes their holding, and then just jumps to its answer. Right? We don't have actually what we hope to see in a legal argument or a legal judicial opinion, where you go through the cases and the cases explain to you why Hannah should get that brooch in the end. Instead, they go through the summary of the cases and then they're like, we'll give it to Hannah. That's why actually I find this case to be very difficult, because the legal precedent that it sets up does not give us a very satisfying reason for why this conclusion is that it should go to the finder and not the landowner. I think there's actually, you could have read the cases and come to the opposite answer as well. Harry, you want to add something or ask something?
I'm wondering if people can have used the rationale solely to defend against Hannah and keep the value of the crop.
Amy, he tried, right? He tried. And you see how, like, the cases that are cited often kind of privilege the landowner. That this is your land, this is where we found it. If it was embedded or attached to the land, it makes sense. All right, let's think about our public policy reasons. What public policy reasons support awarding this to Hannah? What do you think, Jamie?
Well, found it. So I feel like if someone finds something that they should typically be entitled to it.
All right, so maybe we just have a public policy idea that is like, we want to support people finding stuff. Anything else? Craig?
Similar to like adverse possession, where you're supposed to know what's around and in your property, he should have known what was in his house and like checking in on his house.
I love that theory. I would hate that in practice. Right? Somebody's like, oh, you didn't realize you had this $5 in your old pair of jeans? It's mine now. You weren't diligent enough in knowing what's in your house, right? But maybe we have some of the same ideas we see in adverse possession. We want things to be used. To have kind of a brooch hidden away that nobody knows about does not add any productive value to society. Nobody is enjoying that brooch. Nobody is kind of looking at it. Nate?
He returned to the police and did like good faith stuff.
We really want to encourage honesty. We like honesty. We think that it is the most likely to go back to the true owner if somebody actually comes forth and reports it, right? If we had a different rule, we might get somebody like Hannah just pocketing the thing, right? If they didn't think that they had a chance of becoming the true owner, but maybe they wouldn't be kind of as good about turning it over to the police. And we want to encourage that behavior. So I think that there is definitely kind of encouraging finding, helping to thinking about what's the best way to return it to the true owner. It's going to be like reporting it to the police. I think that there's also... Frankly, I think there's something about like a big, rich, wealthy guy who owns a big, fancy house and has a lot of money versus this poor soldier who got paid like nothing, and we would kind of want to reward him for his service. I think that there's some of that little background thought going into what the judge is thinking. All right, what would be a policy reason in favor of awarding it to Hannah? I mean, to Peel, to the landowner. Yeah, Kayla.
I would say, like, if you're letting someone stay in your house or being forced to, someone snooping around your drawers or, you know, behind little secret walls or something.
Yeah, right, you want to cut it. Absolutely. So we can see, actually, while this court, we see that there's actually public policy arguments on either side. We don't really like the idea that somebody coming into your home could become an owner of something they find within your home. I think that one of the most persuasive things to this court was the fact that he never occupied his home. We would generally think of the owner of the land, the owner of the locus in quo, ratione soli, as I would say, we would generally think of that person as being kind of in constructive possession of all the things on the land. And they said because he never even was there, he didn't even know about it, we're not going to treat him as a constructive possessor. This case is a little bit harder to reconcile, I think, with our other cases. I think the other cases give us nice, clear rules. Armory gave us a nice, clear rule. The first person to find it gets to keep it, right? And we'll see some of the other cases have relatively clear rules. This one, we have this messy thing when it comes to kind of land ownership sometimes. We have to start asking these things like, does the public have access to this land, right? Is it embedded in the soil? Were you working for somebody? It gets a little bit more complicated. What if Hannah were a trespasser? What if he wasn't like stationed there, but what if he was just somebody who kind of saw that it was empty and decided to spend the night there and he found the brooch? Should he get it then?
He wouldn't, because the public policy argument will be that you're encouraging trespassing or rewarding the trespasser, which is not something that we want.
Yeah, that's right. So, exactly. We wouldn't want to encourage trespassing. Lost property statutes generally assume that the person was properly there, had a right to be there. Let me see if I have... Come on, go down. Mm-hmm. Try this thing. I'm having a lot of slide trouble today. There we go. All right, so one of the things that we have, we'll see is becomes a tricky question is trying to figure out whether or not we characterize something as lost, mislaid, or abandoned. That's just a random picture of a brooch. So here's one. All right, Jayla, are you a homeowner? You are now. You own a home, and you hired Amanda to do some repairs on your house. Oh, she's back there. She's trying to trick me. While she's working, she finds a hidden cache of money beneath the floor. Your money? Amanda's money.
It's mine.
Mine? Why is it yours? All right, Amanda, what do you think?
She lives there?
She lives there. She did not know that the money was there. It was probably there before she moved in, or somebody unbeknownst to her went into her house and hid some money underneath the floorboards. Okay, so you think it belongs to Jayla, but that you should get some finder's fee for kind of unearthing it for her?
Yeah.
All right, Kayla?
But is Jayla and Amanda considered an employee at that point?
Uh-huh. All right, so she's your... If you're her employee, then if she's the employee, what happens, Kayla? It would go to the homeowner. If we think about kind of that case we read about that they referred to, the South Stratfordshire, about them, like, digging up dredging the lake and finding the rings. Jamie, were you going to say the same thing?
Yeah.
All right, okay. This is a New York case, Niagara Falls case. The trial court actually awarded it to the homeowner. Same theories, right? This is her employee that is working for her. She owns this property. However, the appellate division overturned this case. This is a 1968 case. The appellate court found that the finder was an independent contractor. And therefore not an employee. She was on the premises legally, so she got the money. Right, so now that actually so this is our jurisdiction, folks. Right, so this is the rule where we live. But we see how. So it's a very interesting thing, because I think that even before we took into account the employee idea, even before Kayla brought that up, people still felt like the money should go to Jayla. Even Amanda said the money should go to Jayla. Right, so we see that there is we can get some pretty complicated. Outcomes, right, when we have these ones that are things found in homes that people didn't know about. It's kind of like this own special category of finders. It happens more often than you think, right? People move into a home, or sometimes they buy an old piece of furniture and it has, like, you know, something in the back drawer that they didn't realize was there. I did buy a pair of pants once at the Salvation Army that had $20 in the pocket. I believe I paid $4 for the pants. There was no part of me that thought about turning that $20 back in and reporting it to the true owner or who that might be, because I'm a jerk. Okay. Right, but let's think about this a little bit. Let's think a little bit more about this lost versus mislaid idea with the McAvoy versus Medina. Danelle, can you help us with this one?
Explain it. Lost Heart of McAvoy and Snapshot.
No, not the plaintiff. Who loses this wallet?
It was a customer.
Customer, yeah.
No,
did you say customer entertainer? That's probably true.
No, the plaintiff found the pocketbook.
Okay.
In the barbershop.
And where was it in the barbershop?
It was laid on the table, lying on the table.
Okay. So he finds it. What does he do with it?
He notifies the defendant.
Mm-hmm.
And so he tells them where he found it, and the plaintiff told him to keep it, and if the owner shows up, and he gives it to the owner.
All right, did the owner show up?
No.
All right, so then what happens?
Plaintiff brought suit. The court was saying that the pocketbook wasn't lost, it was mislaid. And with that, therefore, plaintiff didn't acquire a right to the pocketbook. It was the defendant's duty to notify the owner and give it back.
Okay. So I think we can all kind of, the facts of this case are very easy for us to picture, right? A guy's at a barbershop getting his hair cut, and he walks over and he sees on the counter there's a wallet sitting there, and he said, "Hey, somebody forgot their wallet." What would you do if that was you? You said, "Hey, oh, I found this wallet. Somebody forgot their wallet." What's the most common thing people do? You can confess to me that you pocketed if you want. How do you pronounce your name? Tyler?
Tyler.
Okay, Tyler.
People take the money out, and then, like, you know.
Okay, that might be a choice that somebody might take the money out and leave the rest. I believe we don't have ID here, right? Because this is why we have trouble getting it back to him. So it's just, think of it almost more like a money clip, right? It's just the money. All right, what else might you do? Anybody here who wouldn't pocket it?
Yes, they keep it with the shop owner and the person comes.
I think that's very common. If we were to find a wallet or you know, anything, right? You find a purse, a necklace, something, and you're at a place of business. You're at your hair salon. You're at your barber shop. You're at a store. You take it up to the counter and you say, "Hey, somebody must have dropped this, or somebody left this here." Right? All of us have done it. So what happens in this part is he said, "I guess this is a decent amount of money." And he put up advertisements to see if anybody's lost some money, come by and describe it, and it'll be yours or something like that, something along those lines. And then the guy who was there getting his haircut comes back. Well, I don't know how much later it says. When he comes back, he said, "Anybody show up? That's mine now, right?" And the barber says, "Oh, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have that anymore." And he finally figures that he's lying about that. He tries to get it back. Does not give it back. He goes to court to sue. All right. Now, if we're thinking just about what we've learned in the last two cases, in particular like the Armory case, who should be the owner of this money? Right. So generally, we just learned that if you find a lost item, you are the rightful owner of it unless there's somebody who can show that they possessed it before you. And we don't have that here, right? The barber shop owner did not realize that he had it beforehand. All right. But instead, it's not lost. What is it?
Mislaid.
What's the difference?
The court made the distinction that to place a pocketbook on the table and to simply forget to take it isn't necessarily losing it, in the sense that the prior cases talked about.
Yeah, isn't that weird? It's weird, right? Okay, when you use the word lost versus mislaid, do you make a distinction? Anyone kind of when they're like, "Oh, I've mislaid my keys. I've lost my keys." Yeah, Kayla, you use mislaid.
Yeah, because like I lose things misplace things all the time. But if I say the word lose, I mean like it's never coming back.
Is that how most people do it?
That's
yeah, if I can't find my phone, which happens like every day, right? I can't find my phone. Do I say I've lost my phone, I've misplaced my phone, I've mislaid it somewhere? I generally say I lost my phone, and I think, but not necessarily, but you're right, some people might use that word at the higher threshold than I do to mean that they really have no idea where it is, which it happens to me sometimes as well. Christian?
I was going to say that I think there's a difference, like, when if I remember leaving my phone somewhere, if I don't remember where, I'll think I misplaced it, as opposed to if I don't know where it is, I don't know if I've dropped it, or if someone's taking it, and I would consider it lost as opposed to misplaced.
All right, let me ask you a harder question. Can you look at an item and determine whether or not you think it is lost or mislaid? Arthur?
I guess depending on like where it is, like its location. Like if you saw a wall like on the sidewalk, you would definitely just think that fell out of someone's pocket. As opposed to like if it was sitting by, you know, a cash register at the grocery store, that was someone probably set it down there and forgot to pick it back up.
Okay, right. All right, so my keys, right? My keys are right here. Are they lost or mislaid?
I know exactly where they are.
But if you guys walked in the room and you saw some keys here, lost? Mislaid? Lost or mislaid?
Lost.
Oh, come on. Why it gets very complicated when we have to think about the facts of how the things were found. So why, Anel, is this a mislaid property, not lost property?
Well, I think the court was saying that the fact that it was money and it was placed on the table, like, you wouldn't, a reasonable person wouldn't think that they would have just voluntarily left it there. I mean, they just lost it. Not really.
Good, did they lose it? Careful.
No, they misplaced it, but I'm not really sure how the court determined that it was lost versus, I mean, misplaced versus lost.
Right? This is what's tricky. What is good evidence? What's a good argument here to suggest that this is mislaid property? Ben?
Well, they said it was voluntarily placed, so I think it was intention.
I have no idea.
It looks intentional.
Okay, that's what we have to go with, right? We can't tell, actually, if it was voluntary. We have to think about what does it look like. It looks like it was voluntarily placed there. Why does it look like that?
Because that's what the tables are for setting it down, I guess.
Something like that. Like, maybe it's near the cash register, and we think maybe the guy took it out and left it there when he was, like, paying for his haircut. Any argument to suggest that instead we should call it lost property? Yeah, Jill.
He never came back.
He never came back. If he really like took it out when he paid, and like he might have a better memory that he did that, come back and look for it. If he really has like, if it really kind of fell out of his pocket and he didn't know about it, maybe. Right? Okay, but I hope we understand the difficulty here is we are now going to make this distinction whether or not something is lost or mislaid. By not being able to ask that person and interview them, by just looking at the object and where it is and what it is and see, does this look like it was lost or mislaid? Jamie?
I understand what was just said about how the person didn't come back and get the wallet, so maybe that's an argument for it being lost, but at the same time, I don't know that that's strong because the whole idea of it is that it's lost. Like, he maybe looked for it in other places, but
yeah,
didn't know that it was at the barbershop because he lost it.
I think maybe the idea is... Right. Okay, so here's the idea. Like, you're trying to remember back on where you might have lost something. If you physically put it down somewhere when you were, like, paying your bill, you might have a better memory of that happening. It might be way in favor of the idea that it was misplaced. If you, right? Does that make sense? Whereas if it just falls in your pocket, you have no idea where it happens. I think it's just something about the idea of, like, if you had to do a physical action of putting it down versus it falling out of your pocket, you're more likely to remember where that happened. Which is why, who gets the ownership?
ownership of Miss Lane property?
The owner of the property, owner of the premises.
The owner of the premises, and why is that?
I think it was
Locus and Quo.
Yeah, that's our fancy Latin phrase. Just be like, the owner of the premises gets it. But why do they get it? What's the reason for making that rule?
I would think, just given what the phrase means, the place where the cause of action arose, I guess it would be better to give it to the person that owns the premises as opposed to the finder.
But why? Why is it better to give it to the person who owns the premises?
Because it's mislaid and it really doesn't belong to...
But we're getting a little circular here, right? We need to think about, when we're thinking about the rules should be, we want to think about the public policy reasons. And we just talked in the last case about public policy reasons in favor of giving it to the finder. We want to encourage honesty. We want to encourage people to find it. What would be, if we were going to give it to, that would make sense here too. Like, we're encouraging the guy to report it by giving it to him in the end.
Well, in case the original owner comes back.
Yes. That's the reason, that's the public policy reason for the rule. What do we really want our finder's law to do? We want it to make the rules that are going to be most likely to return those objects to their true owner. The most likely thing to do that is to give it to the barbershop owner because that's where the true owner is most likely to come. They're most likely to come back to the barbershop to look for it. They're going to have no idea where this finder is to go track him down to try and get it. So you can see we have two public policy things that are kind of competing with each other here. Now, if you're McAvoy and you happen to know that the public, that the law says that the owner of the locus and quo is going to keep that money, does that change your behavior in reporting it? Maybe, I mean, it depends how honest you all are, right? But we can see how this rule actually encourages people who find things at places of businesses to pocket them. Right? In a way that's different if you found that wallet out in the street, like no locus and quo, you usually can get it back. Right? If it's lost, even within the place of business, right? You might suddenly be like, wallet on the table. Oh, look who's placed. Oh, lost. Now I will get it back. Right? So it's a very strange rule, this lost versus displayed rule. And it makes it hard kind of for our factual evidence-based inquiry to try and kind of look at these objects and try and figure out where they are. Okay. Remember we talked about bailors and baileys last time? One way to think about this, and some of the phrases you sometimes use, is the idea that this was an involuntary bailment. And therefore, the owner of the property, the owner of the business, the locus and quo, is going to act as an involuntary bailee. And remember, we talked about last time how that comes with kind of certain duties of care. It means they can't, like, they shouldn't just destroy it. They should kind of look after it for a while. Sometimes courts don't seem to think about that when it's money. But sometimes when it's an object, we kind of give the owner of that locus and quo some kind of responsibility to suggest they need to safeguard it, at least for some period of time. Perhaps the period of time that we would think of it as being adverse possession or something like that. Like, you find something very valuable, maybe we think you need to kind of look after it, not destroy it or sell it for a couple years. But the law is actually hazy on that, once we give to the locus and quo what their duties are. All right, let's see. all right, we'll do some examples after this. But let's do Haslam versus Lockwood. Oh, Tim is not here, of course. I told you, I have a magical power to call on the people who do not come each day. All right, so what do I have? One of the many Sams. Sam L. Can you help us with this one? All right, what's going on in Haslam versus Lockwood?
Okay, so
I think you have to be a little louder.
There was manure on the side of the road, and the plaintiff told two friends to, like, gather it in the heaps. And then, so it was, like, a public highway, so, like, the manure didn't really belong to anyone, except for, like, the city. So there at the end of the day. And then the defendant took the heat for himself to like his land, and then the plaintiff wanted to get the heat back.
Yeah, so he wants the heat back. Is this an action in Trover or Clubbin? Plevin, you think he wants the poop? It's an action in Trover. He's not actually requesting the return of that exact manure to him. He doesn't have a special attachment to that that particular manure. He's asking for the money value of it, which is a whole separate question of what is the money value of it. All right, so this is Bleecker in Bedford. Anyone been to this intersection? No? I mean, this isn't New York City. Nobody knows Bleecker Street? Yeah, okay, right? Some people, we know where we are. We're in the heart of the village here. I don't know how well you can tell from this picture that those are piles of horse shit along the sides of the road. People think about... I love your faces. Jesse right now had the best one. All right, so people think about the fact that cars are bad for the environment. Well, it used to be that cars were looked as a solution to this environmental problem of just having manure all over the streets. All right, so we need to try and figure out who owns this manure, and we see you mentioned that maybe the city owned it. What's the claim for the city owning it?
That it was like on their property.
Yeah, so the city as the kind of the locus in quo or something like that. Or maybe we think of this as real property. Remember we talked about these things attached, that real property is anything attached to the land or embedded in the land. Should we consider this to be real property and put it under real property rules? Yeah, well, so the defendant tries to argue that this is real property, so we should be kind of looking at the rules governing real property, and it shouldn't be kind of fall into this like lost, misplaced, abandoned chattel, weird land. And the court rejected that. The court said, no, this is not part of your property. It's not embedded in your property. It's not part of the land. It was something that was kind of deposited on the land. And it just does that in a kind of a conclusory sentence. It says, this principle does not apply to the droppings of animals driven by travelers upon the highway. Of course, we could see if we were kind of in a more rural area that we would think of that as being part of the land almost, right? If you were out on a farm, you would likely not differentiate too much from the cow patties, from the other dirt and things on the land. So there are some circumstances where we might look at manure as actually being part of land and part of real property. But in this context, in the city streets, it's not. All right. This lost, mislaid property? Which do you think it looks like?
I don't know. Like, abandoned? Mislaid?
Okay, wait, right? We have to be very careful here. Is it lost, mislaid, or abandoned?
I would say abandoned property because they weren't
actually yet. Yeah, how do we determine whether or not something is abandoned property? Right, we talked about our lost and mislaid.
Not like they just didn't want it, like they were.
But remember, we're not asking the people who were driving the horses. We have to look at the item itself and try and make that distinction. So we have to look at the manure along the highway, along the road here, and try and determine whether that manure looks to us like it is lost, mislaid, or abandoned. How might we make that call? What do you think? If you saw a bunch of horse manure on the road, what would you think?
Mislaid
it? Alright, mislaid it suggests that they put it down kind of purposely. They have some intention, perhaps, but we also assume it's something that they want.
I would consider it something abandoned as if there's a lot or a huge amount of it. I don't think you put a huge amount of horse manure in the ground. So that, just looking at the amount, I feel like...
Okay. All right, so we can see how these types of things, these types of facts might help us, right? There's a whole mess of it. Right? And that is not, so it does not suggest that it's something that somebody just accidentally put there. So the court says, this is abandoned property. We have no suggestion or idea from anything surrounding the circumstances that we think that people are going to, who are driving their horses down the street, are likely to come back and try and reclaim this. They've made no efforts to do so. There's no suggestion that they do so. We'll see in the next case that abandoned can be kind of sometimes hard to determine. But here the court says, this looks like it's abandoned to us. Or it's now if it is abandoned property, if we kind of checked off, it's not lost, not enslaved, it's abandoned. Who owns abandoned property?
The person who, property is on. They said the city owned
it. They said the city could make a claim, and we don't really get into kind of the strength of the city's claim, because the city is not making a claim here. So instead, when we have a case before us that's about kind of found property, we can only deal with kind of the rights between the two people before us. And the two people before us are the guy who had his employees gathered up into piles, and the second one who went out and kind of scooped up those piles before the guy had a chance to come back.
So it'd be the guy who found it and hired the people to...
Okay, based on what principle?
That his labor, paid for it and scooped up some of the value of the property for his work.
So the general rule is that the person who finds abandoned property is entitled to keep it. So we have a little bit of confusion here about whether or not. I think we figured out who the first finder is, right? It's the guy who sees it, hires some people to go scoop it up. The question is whether or not he loses his title to it by not kind of immediately running out and taking it all away. And in that case, I think actually our more helpful things to think about are the Fox case or the Shaw case, right, about the fish in the nets. So now we need to figure out, okay, so we think that the first finder has the best rights to it. Now we need to figure out whether or not we think he lost his rights to it by not kind of taking it away right away. So now if you think about either Pearson v. Post or Fox case or State versus Shaw about the fish in the nets, which one do you find more helpful here?
We like the fish in the nets because people have the fish in the nets and they didn't eat and they go take them out. So you kind of scoop it up. And of course, the group in a reasonable amount of time had to ask for the manure to not be in anymore.
Yeah. So if we think of the manure as like a wild fox, we feel like he doesn't really have full control over it when he left it there in piles, and then the next person who comes and grabs it should be able to kind of claim possession of it. But the court suggests that's not actually the right kind of analogy. And although they don't, the timeline doesn't work, they don't cite State v. Shaw, we see it's more of the thinking of the idea that he brought it under his control. He exercised dominion over it by putting it into these piles. And therefore, he should have a reasonable amount of time to go get his cart and bring it back and pile it up. But he has kind of, by gathering it together, that is kind of in similar in ways. We see how it becomes very similar to the guys who have the fish in their nets and somebody comes up and hauls them up. These cases look kind of similar here. We're just dealing with what we think of as a chattel instead of what we think of as a wild animal and kind of trying to figure out what the rule should be. I felt like I saw a hand. I was imagining it. Okay, so, all right, so we see that we also might have public policy reasons that are behind this rule. What public policy reason might we have here?
If someone hires people to do, you don't want people to be able to, come over and take, the proceeds of, the work, they don't get the benefit of it. So, it would, allow people to just, watch someone else do it and they don't take it for themselves.
Right, so it's kind of, as you mentioned earlier, right, it's like the labor theory. We feel like, putting the time and energy into gathering up this manure is something that we should reward. We shouldn't allow people to kind of come and take it away at the last minute. We also have probably a policy that we really are happy with people who clean up the poop, and we don't want to discourage that from happening. So people who are actually willing to invest time and energy in doing this, we want to kind of reward their efforts in that way. So I think that's definitely kind of some of the policy reason going behind a rule like this. There.
The board talked about that it will save public officers the expense of having to remove that from the street, so they want to encourage that kind of activity.
Yeah, and as we think about public policy, we can always think of it in kind of two ways. One is just like the general rule. What does a general rule that allows a first finder some time to kind of gather things together, what is this? It gives them a reasonable amount of time. They say, that's probably like 24 hours, right? That is a general rule. It could be a useful rule because the people are exercising control over it. And then we can think about the policy in this case in particular, which is we want to encourage people to clean up the streets. And so we see both kind of both the general and the specific public policy ideas really favor kind of giving it to the guy who invests the time and energy in here. Yeah.
Can you say the defendant also invests some time and energy to clean it up?
This is the same thing with the Fox case in a way, right? When we're thinking about the Fox case in the labor theory, we're like, well, there's the one guy who put all the time and energy into like running, getting the hounds and the horses and stuff, but the other guy actually invested time and energy by grabbing it too. I think it's just kind of who we feel is more important labor to encourage. Like, you put more labor into it first. Like,
I think that I think we should have, I don't know, perhaps some sympathy with both parties in this case. You know, if you're walking along and you see the piles have been piled up, you might think to yourself, somebody's planning to take that later. Or you might think to yourself, well, the city's probably just in the process of cleaning stuff up. He goes and asks the city, anybody want that? Anybody lay claim to that? And they tell him no. And he's like, all right, I guess I'll go truck it out to my farm. Like, in many ways, if you just think about the action of the second guy, it doesn't look too kind of nefarious or sneaky in the same way it did with the fish case. In the same way, those are clearly somebody else's nets that he was kind of pulling up and eating the fish. This guy actually kind of saw it and went and checked with the authorities, and they said, oh, no, we don't know who's doing that. You can do it. I don't know. Are there any, I was trying to think if there's any other kind of instances where we see things like this. The book had, authors had told me, I guess this happens with seaweed. I do not gather seaweed, but I guess that people will gather seaweed, and if they walk along the beach, they kind of put it in piles. You're nodding, you've done this?
No, when I was going overseas in Korea, if you touch pots of seaweed that the divers have collected and set aside, they will.
What about shells? Is that a thing with shells? Like if you're collecting pretty beach shells and you put them in a pile and somebody walks along and sees your pile of shells, can they pick them up or no? No.
There are some, excuse me, cocktails in the Caribbean. They will protect those cocktails because it's a commodity.
Right, and yeah, I mean, I can see that, but I can still think about when I was a kid, I used to just, like, make piles of shells, and sometimes I'd leave them there, or sometimes I'd find a pile of shell, and I'd be like, score! You know, like, so this is why, this is just me not kind of spending a lot of time with shells or seaweed, I guess. What about if you were collecting recyclables, right? So you go around, like, you're going up and down the block, and you're making you put your big pile of recyclables in a bag on the corner. If you leave it there, can somebody else come grab it? What do you think? You've done this?
First time experience. I wrote an article for a newspaper one time that stayed out overnight and followed the bottle collectors around.
Yeah.
And they have the territory and everything. It's all set up. If you're on the
house. Oh, yes. This is very clear in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
I've seen the fights.
I don't know if you. Are you two living in Allentown?
I live in Allentown.
Okay. So I followed Princeton around from like 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. And they have like, they all understand, like, keep coming to my territory, there's going to be a problem.
Well, okay, but that's territorial. I love it because it's actually a great property rights story, right? It's a formal norm setting up kind of property rights and boundaries. But what about if they just have like their garbage, you have a garbage bag full of recycling that you have collected and you leave it on the corner while you do the rest of the street? And somebody comes by and they see that big garbage bag inside.
I think if it's not from someone's house.
Yeah, that's why it's not a great example. Somebody suggested that example to me, and I feel like if it's in front of you, might just think somebody had a really good party. and like it's free for you to die. I don't know. So I'm not sure we have a great analogy for how it would work, you know, the piling up of the manure, but we can see kind of there are these public policy ideas behind kind of wanting to invest in people expending the labor, but sometimes, you know, as Dom's pointing out, like we have this mixture of like, well, they're all kind of doing good work. How do we figure out which one to value? I guess we'll do the one who got there first. Jimmy.
So if this piece took place on someone's farm, then how, like, from my understanding, that it would be considered part of the realty because it was cultivated land, I guess it's like a fertilizer or whatever, but what if the property owners don't necessarily want animals to, like, on their land.
Farmer might. I mean, yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot of things we have to assume. We have to assume that this is kind of, that the people were not trespassing, right? That they had, like, when they were doing this collection, they had right to be on the street and pick these things up, which would be really different than a farm. We'd have to really look at the character of it and determine whether it's abandoned. This court just kind of said, we're not going to treat manure on a public highway as being part of the land. It did not answer the question of whether it would have looked at manure differently if it was deposited on a farm, but I think it probably would. So it's not, this case is not very good for helping us answer that question. All right, let's do our last one in this lost, found, abandoned cycle. Okay, Benjamin, this is Lidner Aviation. Ben, perhaps you can help us with this one.
Okay, so, bag. I think he possessed the ramblage and decided to stop it. And the mechanic, Benjamin, opened the compartment on the wing on a large package of money.
Yes, yes.
That were dated 50s and 60s versus 1995, so it could have been there for a while. And then there was the lawsuit of who should get it.
Okay, all right, so as you mentioned, this is old money. Oh, this is the great drawing, right? There's the money in the wing. Okay, this is old money. Could it be considered treasure trove?
I personally would have considered that, but they did not.
Because?
I would say because no one would, anyone who knew money was there would try to get back, and if they didn't get back, it would be abandoned.
Right, so treasure trove, though, we really are talking about something very old, something that the people who put it there are not going to be alive anymore. This is 35 years old, they figure out from the business. And they said that's just not long enough for it to be treasure trove. Somebody could definitely still kind of be around and be looking for it. So this is why the court says not treasure trove, not really old enough. All right, okay, but what about lost property? Lost or mislaid?
He said it was mislaid because you had to unscrew the panel and screw it back on, so it was intentionally placed there. So you could be hard to just drop something accidentally behind the locker room.
Absolutely, right? So here we see, looking at the circumstances of what what the money looked like, tell us lost versus mislaid. It can't be lost. It's not something somebody dropped unknowingly because it's racked up, it's bundled carefully, they had to take off the screws, they had to place it in there. There's no way, as Ben says, somebody just accidentally did this. So we can't call it lost property. We can call it mislaid property. All right, if it's mislaid property, who gets it?
The owner of the location. In this case, they figured the location to be the plane, not the aviation shop.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so right, we learned that from the McAvoy, from the barbershop case. If it's a mislaid property, it goes to the owner of the locus in quo. We have a kind of this slight issue here because both the owner of the airplane hangar and the owner of the airplane are arguing their locus in quo. That's not really discussed too much. We don't have too much from the owner of the hangar coming out in this opinion. But we see they kind of dismiss that idea. Because if we remember, what was the reason that we give it to the owner of the locus in quo? Most likely, right? But most likely, if you're going to go and try and find your mislaid property, you're most likely to go to the owner of Locus and Quo. We feel like you're more likely in this case to go look for the airplane than to just search around a bunch of mechanic shops and different airplane hangars and figure out if yours had, your airplane had been there at one point or another. So Locus and Quo is going to be the airplane. All right. Now, the Benjamin argues that this is abandoned property. What do you think?
Well, he says that's a problem because anybody who left it there, he's trying to make it seem like drug money so that someone who knows the location has given up a claim to it. So therefore, he can find it and get a copy of the
Right, okay, so if it's abandoned property, it goes to the finder. So it would go to him, unless he might have an issue about him being somebody's employee or something like that. But either way, he would at least get something. All right, but he really wants it to be considered abandoned property because lost and abandoned property go to the finder. Mislaid property goes to Locus and Quo. So he wants to characterize this as abandoned property because we can't sell anybody on loss. Nobody, like, accidentally drops something in an airplane. All right. What are the arguments in favor of saying that this would be abandoned property? Yeah.
Well, I would just with what he said, anyone who knows where that money is today probably is not going to claim it. It's bubbled up suspiciously. They're either dead or they're running for the law.
Okay, exactly. And I think the dissent is in agreement with that, right? That you're not going to forget. It's not like you're not quite sure which tabletop you placed your wallet on. You went through a lot of time and energy to carefully bundle this up, undo the screws. You're not going to forget that it's in an airplane wing. So therefore, the fact that you have not come back and claimed it probably demonstrates that you have no intention of doing so. Right? Because it's a lot of money. You would go back and get it. If it weren't for, I don't know, it's illegal, it's like the money's associated with a crime, you're not around anymore, you're in jail.
Repossessed. So you figure if the bank repossessed your car and you had 100 grand backseat, you just pay off the car and keep the car. So it was kind of suspicious that you're claiming that someone accidentally forgot where they put their money in.
Absolutely. I think all of these things are good evidence in favor of the argument of saying that it's abandoned. Amanda, you have a question?
Yeah, can you kind of argue the whole Hannah and Peel case in that they didn't have any idea it was there, so the finder should get it because the true owner hasn't come forward?
Okay, so now if we think of the airplane as looking like the house in Hannah and Peel, maybe we feel kind of more sympathetic with Benjamin's claim, right? That he actually was the one who found it. He is like the soldier who was working in the area and found it. We'd have to ask the same... I was going to say these... Hannah V. Peel is so annoying. We have to ask the same questions of like, okay, well, who's the owner? It's the owner is the bank. Have they actually possessed it? Have they had an opportunity? And says, yeah, I guess they did. I don't know if they're flying it around. But like they have been in possession of the plane in a way that Peel never was. But I think you're right. We seem to be thinking the airplane doesn't kind of have the same feel to it as a house.
Just going into this first inspection, that doesn't mean that they necessarily had access to it.
I actually think that this case is actually more consistent rule-wise than Hannah v. Peel is. I think Hannah v. Peel is more of our outlier. It's kind of this really weird rule about why you would give it to the guy who finds something in your house. I think as an airplane owner, we might understand why we think that the airplane owner should get the money that was hidden in the wing. Particularly because it sounds like the people that owned the airplane owed the bank money, right? So maybe even more reason why we think there might be some reason to give it to them. All right, so the court does not, despite kind of your convincing arguments, the court does not find this to be abandoned property. Why not?
They just say it's mislaid. It's intentional, but they can't find the owner, so they can't ask them.
Allison?
Because it was such a significant amount of money that no one would intentionally give it up, so they really haven't given up their rights to it, settling and just left it there.
Absolutely, right? That this is like, we would never assume that somebody would abandon something so valuable. We're going to assume people abandon horseshit. We are not going to assume they abandoned $18,000. Francis.
How much does the plane cost?
I have no idea.
If it's being repossessed for $80,000, $100,000, then you know there's $18,000 in it, but it's not worth it? I mean, depending on how much the plane actually costs, it might not be worth it, too. Maybe he lives in China and is not.
But see, yeah, absolutely. But you see how all of these things, all of our kind of ideas, require us to make suppositions about somebody who is not present before the court and who cannot tell us what their motivations were. This is why it's so difficult. We can absolutely look at it and think logically, I can think of reasons why this person wouldn't come claim this money. I can think of reasons why they would like to but don't realize where it is or just can't get there in time. But we don't. We just have to make these suppositions based on what the money looks like. It's bundled up and it's put in a wing. We can't find the owner and go and interview them and ask them about it.
Should it be considered the bank's property given that they acquired it from the owner of the place? Like, it's part of the claim in a sense?
Well, so that's exactly the kind of the argument of it that they're trying to make. That it's like it's almost like saying that something is part of the real estate. There's no way we can categorize it as just being part of the plane. It is something. It is a different object that is put in the plane. In the same way, a necklace found inside the plane wouldn't be part of the plane. It would be an item found within the plane. There's no kind of. I don't know. Maybe if the money is on either side and it's balanced, you use that to like balance out your wings because that, I don't know, that was a good idea. Maybe then you could argue it's part of the plane. But no, so we're going to treat this as not part of the plane, as a separate item that was lost inside the plane. Now, we know it was repossessed. Supposedly that means that we could go and figure out who it was repossessed from or something like that. From the circumstances of this case, nobody has come forward. So that means whoever they repossessed the plane from is not claiming ownership. We have nobody else coming forward and claiming that this money is theirs. We just have kind of this rule we see that the court adopts that we're going to assume that for something valuable, we'll never assume that it was abandoned. It is actually the highest threshold is to show that something is abandoned. Right? We are never going to assume people abandon things, so instead you need to kind of really show us some good evidence that suggests that it's abandoned. And just nobody having shown up in a while is not enough. It's got to be something about the character of where it is. It's got to be like in a garbage can. Right? Where are my keys? If I was going to abandon my keys, I can just place them for a moment. Excuse me. All right. Let's say I was just like, I hate these keys. They never work. They suck. I don't want them anymore. But the next class comes in. They have not heard me say that. They see the keys on the floor. You guys all know that I've abandoned them. I do not want them anymore. What do they know? What are they going to think? Lost keys. Right? So this is why it's so hard. We just have to look at the character of it and figure it out. We were always going to assume that I am not an idiot who throws their keys away. Because these are something that are relatively valuable keys. Now, if it was like an old coffee cup, not with my coffee cups, but if it was like an empty water bottle or something, maybe we would be like, well, that's the type of thing people abandon. It doesn't look like somebody meant to hold on to it. It looks like she thought there was a garbage can over there and she was lost or something. So this is kind of this. So these trios of cases give us kind of these tricky things about abandon and loss go to the finder unless we have something weird about kind of it being within a house, and then we have to ask a couple more questions if it's on somebody's private property. Mislaid goes to locus and quo, goes to the owner of that business. And all of that is going to be things we have to figure out from trying to just look at the object. Yeah, Christian.
When we were discussing the Hannah case, we mentioned that there's a policy to be one to tell us to be used. Sort of like essentially one item to be used efficiently. Is there ever a period of time after which a mislaid item can become abandoned? Like a point where it's mislaid only in name but abandoned in effect? I mean, in this case, it's 35 years and no one's using that money. It just seems,
well, This is a great question. I mean, it just goes to the idea that the circumstances around it are going to help us answer that abandoned question. So I think absolutely we could think about it. Maybe the amount of time suggests to us whether or not we should consider something to be abandoned. But the courts tend to put a pretty high threshold. There's not a definitive rule. There's not a number of years. There's not a specific item. We're going to assume that something valuable is misplaced and not abandoned. And therefore, we have to look at other evidence to try and overcome that presumption. Right? Does that make sense? It's not going to be a hard and fast rule that any time it's valuable, we're going to assume that it's not abandoned. We're going to look at the rest of the circumstances. It was put in a garbage can. It was 18 years ago. All of those things are going to suggest abandonment, even though it is a valuable item. Does that make some sense? All right, let's do some quick examples, and then we'll take our break. All right. Nate, you bought a safe at an auction and you asked Christian to sell it at a garage sale. While he's showing the safe to some people, he finds a wad of cash stuffed between the inner lining and the outer metal wall. Which of you guys should get that money? Who's the finder? Christian's the finder. Well, I would think so, right? there's so many things to think about. First of all, he's the first finder. If we just think of this as lost property, and we think of him as the finder, he should get it. Do we think it's better to call this mislaid property or abandoned property?
Well, I'm a vendor of lender role. We call this mislaid, I guess.
Yeah, unless there's something like we think somehow, I don't know, we'd have to know a little bit more about the safe if there was a hole and it slipped down and they didn't know it was there. But generally, we're going to assume that they put it there. Also, it's valuable, right? So we're going to assume it's not abandoned. So now it's mislaid property. It's not lost or abandoned. So who gets it? Yeah, owner of the locus and quo. And I think much like an airplane, we'd probably say the locus and quo here is the safe. Yeah.
But couldn't one make the argument that unlike a Benjamin case, they just sell the safe, no one sold the airplane? And usually when you sell something, you assume that they're selling that object and all of its contents?
You're saying say that Nate's giving it up because he's giving it to you to sell? Is that what you're saying?
That he's selling me the safe, so I can assume...
He's not selling you the safe. He's asking you to sell it for him. In some ways, you're like his employee here.
All
right. Right. So even if you did find it, even if we said it was lost property that you found, he could still try and argue, but you found it as my employee, and therefore I should get it. I don't want to hurt your brain too much, but there is a case that comes out with the exact opposite answer. I think that's the right answer, but there is an 1878 case, so it's a really long time ago, where somebody found an envelope containing a pile of cash within her employer's kind of paper that she was kind of getting rid of. And they said that was abandoned and it went to the finder. So I guess you see how we have to look at that money and be like, is this abandoned money? Is it lost money? And it's not always easy. Hiro, you're a contractor. You've agreed to demolish Tabitha's building and remove all of the debris afterwards. After demolition, while you're cleaning up, you find valuable bearer bonds inside of an old wall. Now, who should get this? What do they look like? Lost? Mislaid? Abandoned?
Independent contractor?
Sure, we'll let you be an independent contractor.
You said I was?
Yeah, sure. We'll let you be an independent. Let's figure out what do we think. He's not. All right. But what do you think of those bearer bonds, guys? Do you think those are lost, mislaid, abandoned? They're like in the wall.
I guess mislaid. Because I haven't technically abandoned them.
Well, you don't even know if you even knew about them. If you were the true owner, you can come forth, right?
Yeah.
So we don't have the true owner here. So the argument is between you as the owner of the building and potentially as his employer, I guess, and him as the finder. And so now we have to figure out whether or not to characterize it as lost, mislaid, or abandoned. What do you think? What do you guys think?
Well, I want it, so I'm going to claim it. It seems like we'll be there for a long time. You know, I don't know.
All right, Tabitha, what do you think?
I still want to say it seems like.
Because?
Because, I mean, the elements of abandonment don't really seem to coincide with what's going on in the situation. It doesn't seem like...
Does it seem like it's lost?
It doesn't seem like it's lost. Because it's within the walls.
Right.
It doesn't seem like I've abandoned it. I mean, going from, like, abandonment...
This should look very similar to Benjamin, right?
Yes.
This is something valuable that was placed, right? It does not accidentally fall into the wall. It was clearly placed within the wall. And the question is, if we're going to assume that valuable things are not abandoned unless you can show otherwise, you would need to, you know, how to make this claim, you're going to have to come up with some pretty convincing arguments based on the status of the bearer bonds and where they were found that makes us overcome the presumption that they are not abandoned. Right? They're definitely not lost. They weren't, nobody like just dropped them. I mean, maybe some crazy way that somebody accidentally drops them in their wall, but I don't think so. Right? So we think the most logical thing here is mislaid. And then they go to the homeowner. Yeah, Amanda. How does that help him?
Well, if it's lost, then,
but is it lost?
She didn't know about it. Yeah, it could be somebody placed it there, but you never know. It might have just gotten shoved in there somehow.
We never know. You have to sit there. The first question you have to ask with these things is, does it look lost, mislaid, or abandoned? And you have to answer that question solely by looking at the circumstances of the thing. So we look at bearer bonds that are found in part of an old wall, and we say, does that look lost? Does that look like somebody dropped them accidentally? They don't, right? If you're going to place something in the wall, you usually are removing part of the wall. Maybe we can imagine some crazy circumstance where somebody's like in the middle of building a building and accidentally drops their bearer bonds out of their pocket. But we don't do that. We don't usually imagine the most ridiculous things. We imagine them. We think, what is the most logical? Most logical thing here, somebody put them in the wall for safekeeping. That looks mislaid. Now we can say, somebody might argue, well, they were abandoned. They've been there forever. This is a really old building. Nobody has ever come back for them. But the presumption is that a valuable thing is not abandoned. So you're just going to have to make a really convincing argument for why they're abandoned. Maybe it's based on the age of the bearer bond. Maybe it's based on some note he finds later that's like, I'm leaving that house and everything in it. I don't want it anymore. Right? All of those things could be types of edits that overcome abandonment, but it's mislaid. And if it's mislaid, it goes to Tabitha anyway, so it doesn't matter if he's the employee or not.
I wouldn't say it's abandoned. I'm imagining a building that's been torn down. It's just a big pile of rubble. Now it's being moved into a dump truck. It's effectively garbage. So once that happens, it's kind of something I'd say it's abandoned now. I look at it as a scrap metal. The contractor takes a building down. He's free to take all the copper plating and sell it. As long as the owner doesn't say, hey, just so you don't
know, yeah.
Scrap.
I think there's a good argument here that this is the arguments you would use to overcome the presumption against abandonment. And you would say, this just looks like a big garbage can to me. It looks like they just put it in a big garbage can. But you notice that it's not the owner who put it in the garbage can. I'm not suggesting anyway that Tabitha was the true owner of these bearer bonds. Right? So her actions cannot influence the characterization of the property that is abandoned. Right?
Yeah. You say she doesn't own the rubble, now that it's rubble, therefore she doesn't own the rubble.
I guess you could. You could say that she's relinquished all her rights to the resulting debris, and that should include even things she didn't know were in there.
I guess so. It's trickier. Jamie?
So I know courts are hesitant to clear something as treasure trove, but so it seems to me like one of the elements of something being treasure is that it's hidden. And so is the only thing that's distinguishing treasure from mislaid property is the amount of time that it's been somewhere?
Yeah, I was waiting for somebody to say this. Maybe it's treasure trove. Maybe, I don't know how old these bearer bonds are, but if they're really old, maybe we could suggest that they're treasure trove. There is a similar case to this. It went to the owner of the property. It went to them, and they characterized it as mislaid, and it went to them. All right, let's see. I have like two more. We'll do these quickly. Okay. Emma employs two neighborhood boys to clean her barn. Underneath the chicken coop, the kids discover old rusted can filled with silver dollars. This is actually a quite well-known case. What do you guys think? What do you think, Emma?
I think it would be fine for me to say it's like embedded in the land that I own then. Like the rings that they talked about in that other case.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a, right, if it's like underneath the chicken coop, we might want a little bit more. Did they actually have to dig it up, or was it just placed underneath the chicken coop? Right, so there's, we can see how the facts are going to influence us. Does it look like it's lost?
I don't think so. It's not like it was put there intentionally, like hiding it.
Yes. All right, so if it's put there intentionally, like hiding it, that's mislaid.
Yeah.
Could we characterize it as abandoned?
I mean, I could, but I don't know why you would abandon silver dollars.
Right, so what's our assumption?
I think you're assuming that somebody is putting it there to hide it.
Okay.
Under
right, and it's a valuable item. We will always assume that a valuable item was not abandoned. We have to look at other evidence that might suggest it is abandoned. Any evidence suggests that it is abandoned?
I don't think so.
Anybody see anything? James?
The rust.
Maybe the rust suggests that it's been there a long time and they don't plan to come back. Maybe that suggests treasure trove to us. Let me tell you about this case because I find it a funny case. There's this case called Danielson. In that case, the guy hired two boys, 8 and 10, to go clean out his hen house. And they found $7,000 in gold coin. Which, this is an old case. So it says, the math somebody did for me suggests that it would be worth $175,000 today. And an ancient rusted can, old rusted can. The owner claimed, oh, I put those there. Oh, yeah. Oh, hey, kids. I forgot I put those there. He gave the boys each a nickel and said, don't tell anyone about this. Here's a nickel for your troubles. Thanks for cleaning up for me. The Lord will bless you for your silence, he said. The Oregon Supreme Court ruled for the boys, observing that the can and gold pieces were sufficient antiquity that was a near certainty that the true owner had died or disappeared. So they said so we see our presumption is against abandonment, but we could have enough circumstances that kind of weigh the other way. This is not a hard and fast rule. This is like courts looking at the facts and trying to balance them. It makes it kind of tricky. Okay, the court cited Armory to say that they get it. Let's see. All right, this is my last one. Shazia rents an apartment from Rosa. She finds a sack filled with uncut diamonds, which underneath the bottom shelf of one closet. This never happens to me, by the way. I don't understand why these people are. Shazia is not here, yeah. Okay, all right, what do you think, Rosa? Well, let's see. Do they look lost?
Yeah.
No. Does it look mislaid?
Yeah, maybe. I think they would. Could also be a treasure.
Okay, so we have like a couple different things we're muddying together there. So if it's treasure trove, if we think this is treasure trove, we really are just asking, like, is this something really old that somebody hid there long ago and they're likely dead? I'm not sure we have anything with these facts that suggests that. We need additional information, like, how old is the building, right? How long has that apartment been there? When's the last time you, like, redid the flooring? All of those things will help us answer the question of whether it's treasure trove. I'll tell you that it's not old enough to be that. So now you want to figure out whether or not it looks lost, mislaid, or abandoned. We said no to lost. Does it look mislaid?
Yeah.
And why?
Because the fact that it was
other than the bottom shelf and one closet, it looks like that was purposeful.
Exactly. That's the right word to think of. It looks purposefully done. It looks like there's no accident that they get under there. Somebody purposefully kind of put them in a sack and put it under there. Okay. All right. It's, you know, wedged underneath the bottom shelf in one of the closets. This looks like somebody probably is trying to hide it there. So then so if it's mislaid, who gets it? Property owner, right? Owner of the locus in quo gets it if it's mislaid. Some courts actually go in favor of a renter instead of a property owner when you have a lease circumstance, but because the idea is they're more likely to come to the apartment looking for it than they are to kind of go to the landlord looking for it. But putting that aside, the other thing that we might want to ask is whether instead it looks abandoned. Does this look like it might be abandoned? Because that would also change who gets it.
I wouldn't say it looks abandoned.
Right, it's a really valuable thing. So we're going to assume not abandoned unless we have really good evidence suggesting that they abandon it. No, I think we could envision, actually, maybe they're planning to come back and get this sometime. Right? So it makes sense to characterize this as mislaid and give it to the owner of the property. As I said, in some jurisdictions, the owner of the property, they actually say the occupier of the property, the person renting it out. Think about this as a barbershop, too, right? You're more likely to go back to the barbershop, not whoever the barber is leasing the shop to. It might be kind of a big development corporation that owns a bunch of buildings. You're going to go back to the location itself. Peter, you... Okay, Jesse.
So if it really is based on a true owner coming back and getting something, does that mean the person who gets the diamonds in the end, the owner can't do anything with that?
Say that again?
Can they not do anything with the diamonds if the ruling is that they're waiting for the true owner?
Well, okay, so this is what I was talking about, like this involuntary... If we think about them as being the involuntary bailee, so they're now kind of looking over this property that is this involuntary bailment, we might put some duties on them to what they can do with it, maybe some duties that they have to say keep it for no time. But as we're going to get to in 10 minutes from now after we take our break, we'll get to adverse possession and show that if you actually have it for a while, then it just becomes yours. You know, so you could actually can kind of combine this kind of involuntary bailment with the idea of adverse possession becomes true. Now, a lot of courts actually don't seem to, they just kind of award it to that person and don't require any kind of duty of special care, but realize that the reason we have given it to them is the idea that the true owner might come back. So the true owner can come back and try and claim those diamonds. If you've sold some of them, you probably have to give them the money that you got from the sale, right? If you that type of thing. So you still have a possibility of the true owner making a claim against you. We haven't cut that off just because we've decided the dispute between Shazi and Rosa.
So is that why there aren't more, like, King Solomon split in half type decisions?
Well, so this is interesting. There's a little bit because of that, because we think we want the true owner to be able to get it, so it doesn't, if you have pieces of it all over the place, that doesn't make sense. That's not going to be the best way for them to get it back. But also, that just tends to be how property rules are. The Popov case, the splitting the value, the equitable division of that baseball is really unusual. Usually property follows very much kind of our American style litigation, which are all or nothing rules. We declare a winner. It is yours or his. We do not kind of usually say, you guys all have good claims here, let's just divide up that 18 grand.
Request that in terms of, like, could your claim be, I want to split it?
No, I mean,
we don't
even have, like, look, it's like Trover or Replevin, right? Like, I want the thing or I want the value. You're not kind of, if you just want half the value, just, like, negotiate. Right? This is why actually people should negotiate more than go to court, because courts always and property rules tend to be all or nothing. So you're usually better off negotiating and trying to get something. All right, we're going to take a 10-minute break, and then we'll do adverse possession of stuff. So for those of you who are curious, here's the New York statute. The term lost property, as used in this article, includes lost or mislaid property. New York was really, like, that's a really annoying distinction. How can we figure it out? We'll make the same rule for lost or mislaid. It does not matter whether you find it on the floor or on the counter. I should look this up. I do not know what waifs is. Abandoned property waifs. and treasure trove. I looked up the statute, but I didn't get around to looking up ways. Is going to be presumed to be lost property, and such presumption should be conclusive unless it's established. So this is interesting. So we put the presumption always on lost property. If the presumption is lost property, who gets it? Finder. So we don't kind of have the same kind of locus and quo presumptions in New York that we have in other states. We presume that the finder has it. Now, that's a presumption, right? We could actually overcome it with abandoned property, but still it means for the most part it goes to the finder. We actually have, as we do in many states, we have very specific rules about kind of how long until we, I should remember this number. This was a while ago. I looked this up, but it's something like if it's over $20, you are supposed to turn it into the police or the owner of the establishment. Failure to do so is actually technically against the law in New York.
So you broke the law.
When I found the $20 in those pants, I was in California. I'll pull up the California statute. But possibly, are you guys gonna like? You guys gonna write nasty letters to, like, she does not deserve her job as a law firm?
Ethics.
You're gonna bring me up on ethics. Yeah, what are you gonna do? Disbar me?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't need that for this job. No. I would be very sad. I will also confess to you that every now and then I drive over the speed limit.
That's it.
I know you guys are storming off now.
Yeah. Oh, you looked it up? You mean on that phone that you're asleep in your class?
So good they understand my feet in this flesh where to go back to the state.
Ooh.
What?
Same
weird. Things that a thief is like throwing.
Possibly.
Thank you. Things a thief is throwing behind him to effect his escape.
So it's like if you're running from a bank and you start throwing $100 bills.
I wonder how common this is. All right. I'm somehow even less surprised that I did not know that term. There's just rules. There's rules. You get it to, you get, turn it over to police, and then you can come back and whatever it is, like 6 months or a year, to claim it against
Jamie. If you don't turn it over to the police and someone decides to tell them, you're going to get charged like stealing.
It's like ownership of other ownership. I mean, you have to ask your crim professors. They'll really love me for that. I don't know. It's like possession of property that's not rightfully yours. I don't know exactly what the infraction would be. The likelihood of them prosecuting you for picking up the $20 bill that you find on the street. I mean, I guess it'd have to be a $50 bill because it has to be over 20. But all right, I'm going to skip these examples. All right, so let's go to adverse possession of chattels. Now, oh my God, it is amazing that I can figure out who's not going to be here by writing their name. All right, adverse possession, right? We remember setting adverse possession of property, of real property, and that we had kind of all these different policy reasons behind it, and then we had kind of all these different elements that we have to met. Those same policy reasons, and for the large part the same elements with just some twists on them, still hold when we get to adverse possession of chattels. And, I was going to call on Ian. He's not here. Now I got to call on somebody randomly. God, it is true, Shazi. I pull out the card of the people who are not here. I don't know how I do it. What? There's an assignment doing your lawyer class today. But you guys will still notice, like, I do not know how it happens, but, like, I absolutely, like, pull out the name of the, like, I was going to call on Ian today. I was going to call on Shazia today. Like, they know. Even when I don't know. I just don't know how. I was going to call on Tim. Tim, not there, Tim. Tim, not there, Tim. That one. All right. I mean, I don't want to do it. Martha. Oh, God damn it. You're shitting me. I'm not saying these people don't have... I'm not even saying they don't have... valid excuses for being gone. I'm just saying it is like uncanny my ability to do this. Let's try it. I'm just choosing blindly. Beth. Oh. All right. Violin, yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry, that's 196, the old book, I think. 199 in the new one.
So, essentially, a person purchased a violin for his daughter to use. As it turned out, unbeknownst to him, the violin had originally been stolen before it was sold to him. And eventually, I'm not sure if all the original owner came to, like, see it or view it or come in contact with it, but realized that it was originally his, it was worth some money, and wanted it back. So then, basically looking at it as adverse possession of it.
Absolutely. So he comes... So he learns about his property is in the hands of another, so he sues for what would you guess? Conversion, right? It's a conversion suit, right? So he's trying to get it back. And the defense is that this is mine, rightfully mine, by adverse possession. I've met the elements of adverse possession. Let's go through them then, Beth. What are the elements of adverse possession?
The actual possession. Actually have it.
Remember when to think about. Don't think about him not actually having it. Think about.
In my, like, adverse possession mind. Right?
Well, let's journey into it together. Actual, right? Same elements as before. Actual possession. Does the adverse possessor, does Reynolds and his daughter, do they have actual possession of the violin? Yes, they have it. It is in their hands. They actually possess it. Remember, actual possession is like using it as an owner would. They have the violin, they use it as an owner would. All right, is it exclusive possession?
Yes.
Right? They are not sharing it with anybody else. They are not sharing it with the previous owner. All right, what else? What's another element?
Open and notorious.
Open and notorious. Do we have open and notorious?
Yeah, they had it on display, I guess, when it wasn't being used in, like, their family room, and that she's been using it, carrying to and from practice, over the time that they
Okay, so this is the tricky thing, right? Open and notorious, when it was talking about land, people could actually go to that land and look at it. Now we're saying open and notorious is her just having her violin in the family room and carrying it back and forth to school.
What's the nature of the thing in question? How would you use it? Essentially, I would guess the only way you're going to use it is when you're practicing it. Usually, people practice, in their house or where they are, so that's where you would keep it. And you're not going to be carrying your violin around with you to the store and to school, maybe, but. Nature of it, she was using it as notoriously as she could.
Right, so think about how tricky this is. We have kind of a violin, open and notorious use of violin. If we think about it in terms of the person, the true owner, trying to kind of claim possession of it, how is he going to know that somebody else has it if it's just like they're playing it in their house? If we think of the open notorious element in terms of real property was to give the landowner notice. Right? It was the idea that somebody walking onto that property could look at it and tell that you were making a claim. You were able to kind of understand and see what was going on. This is really hard for Chattels. How is the property owner, how is the Bagwell, how is he supposed to figure out where the violin is? So we see that this is a struggle for him. At the same time, though, we can be kind of perhaps sympathetic with Reynolds and his daughter. What are they supposed to do? Everything you buy, are you supposed to assume maybe was stolen once, and therefore you should be kind of posting pictures of it on the internet and displaying it in your window so people walking by could see it? We can see that they are not hiding it. So this is the thing we see some places. They talk about whether or not if they're not actively trying to conceal it, then they're kind of using it in an open and notorious manner. What about concealment here? Are they concealing it?
The only argument the plaintiff kind of had was that the varnish had been changed on it, so it appeared a little bit differently.
Did that constitute concealment?
No. I don't think in this case it
Do you see why it didn't constitute concealment in this case, though?
Wasn't it? Was it because it was a, I don't know, a natural thing you would do with a violent?
Not exactly. Yeah, Will?
Wasn't it after they concealed it after the statute of limitation?
Yeah, in fact, they didn't even engage in an in-depth inquiry of whether or not that would count as concealment, because they said you had already become the owner at that point, because it was after the statute of limitations. So, potentially changing the appearance of it, painting it pink, removing the varnish, all of these types of things could be, covering it with, I don't know, stickers. It's so sad to think of, because it's, of course, a very fancy, valuable violin. But all of those things maybe could be concealment that the court didn't answer, because it said all of that happened after they had already established ownership by adverse possession. All right, so open and notorious is the hardest element when we're talking about adverse possession of chattels. We see that some courts usually say you're open and notorious as long as you're using the item in a way an ordinary owner would and you're not trying to hide it, not doing active concealment. Some other places say, you know, we could say a good evidence of it being open and notorious is that you kind of have it on display publicly. But that doesn't make sense for all items, right? Some people suggest we should have some rule that says you use it in a way that would notify the owner of the property. That is really hard. What is this little girl playing her violin supposed to do that might, I mean, she's not a famous violinist yet, so she's not out like playing her violin and showing it to the world at Carnegie Hall. So we can see how our policy ideas here are very tricky. Right, so what is the policy, Beth, behind allowing adverse possession?
So
just in general, when we talked about adverse possession, why do we have it?
I think it's to make sure the property is being maintained and used and to good purpose. So here it would be, it's kind of weird though here because you don't know if it was stolen, so you don't know if it was necessarily not going to be put to good purpose prior because it was theft.
Right. I mean, so encouraging the productive use of property is one of our motivations for adverse possession. It gets a little weird when the other person probably would have been using it productively as well if it hadn't been stolen. But the idea is if we don't allow kind of people to become owners of this property, we're just going to have kind of cloudy, messy title. And if there's a good reason to kind of allow us to kind of solidify title after, if somebody's had something for a certain number of years, we're going to kind of recognize them as the owner. Because you would just have so much uncertainty if at any time somebody could come and make some claim that something you had was stolen from them long ago. Also kind of, remember one of our other ones was the idea of protecting personhood. Here again, these are tricky, particularly on the facts of this case, but in general, if we think in abstract terms, allowing adverse possession of stuff kind of rewards the person who is actually kind of has and is using the thing. The little girl who's playing the violin every day is kind of has some attachment to it. correcting title defects, I mean, we think of that in the land recording system, but you could just think of that in ownership of things generally. We don't kind of want to have such uncertainty about who owns stuff and the idea that anybody could come and make a claim against you at any time. Alright, what elements are we missing here? What's not yet on our list?
Hostility.
Hostility. Alright, how would we characterize the hostility element here? What do you remember? What does it mean to be hostile? You claim it as your own. And if we were to characterize him as either a bad faith or a good faith adverse possessor, what would we say here?
Good faith.
Good faith, right? He actually thought he owned it. He acted as he was owner. The court kind of emphasizes that, but it doesn't necessarily make that a rule. Describes him as being a good faith purchaser of this. But doesn't actually... In fact, the court cites this case. They cite this Adams v. Kuhn case. In that case, they actually held a thief may take title from a true owner so long as he satisfies the requisite elements of adverse possession. And that is the modern common law. That's the common law view. There's some modern twists on it, but the common law view is that as long as you satisfy those elements of adverse possession, we don't really care if you got it through theft. So think about that now turns that hostility element into an objective standard even for chattels. So the And that, so that kind of mirrors adverse possession of land, right? We don't really care if the person kind of knowingly went in and took your land. We reward that. It feels weirder to us when we do it for stuff, because that means you're rewarding somebody who kind of knowingly went in and took your stuff, and I feel like that just feels different to us than somebody kind of knowingly going in and taking your land. So I said this is the common law view. The modern view is to kind of be hesitant about rewarding a wrongdoer. So we see some jurisdictions who say if you've actually stolen it, you can't gain title, but the common law view is broader. All right, what's our last element?
The statute of limitations.
Right, so continues for the statutory period. All right, what's the statute of limitations here?
2 years.
2 years? That seems really short. How does that compare to our kind of average statute of limitations for land?
Well, for land, I think the shortest was 5 years.
Shortest was 5 years. They're most like 10 to 15. Why is this one only two?
I would say maybe the nature of something that you can move about, more like it's going to be more and more, I guess, displaced from its original owner. So 2 years kind of makes things a little less messy.
Well, yeah, all right. Maybe we just have so much to kind of moving around. Personal property is just easier to move around, so therefore we want to kind of settle the claim earlier. Jesse, you're in
safe. Things like the violin could have broken, and they have a much shorter lifespan than a piece of land.
Yeah, exactly. They're not going to last quite as long, perhaps. Another thing, kind of historically, is just that land is usually much more valuable. I mean, this is a valuable violin, but for the most part, when we think of personal property, it's just not as valuable as, like, you know, 10 acres of land. So we're going to kind of be a little bit more generous to the landowner to give them a little bit more time to get their land back. We think there's kind of a different. But mostly it has to do with this idea that it's just easier, like, the stuff is, like, not going to last as long, and it's easier to move around. We want to kind of settle the claim earlier than waiting around 10 or 15 years. Okay, one of the hardest things to figure out in these cases, though, is when do we start the clock for the statute of limitations. In this case, when do they start the clock?
They started the clock from the time that they bought it.
Yeah, in fact, some of the language here suggests they were even starting the clock from the date that it was stolen. But I think that the better answer is they're starting the clock from the date that Reynolds had possession of it. We'll see in the next cases that some courts don't feel like that's the appropriate time to start the clock. All right, tacking. What was tacking? We talked about that earlier in kind of real estate adverse possession.
Tacking would have been if someone had possession of the violin prior, so let's say the first person stole it, perhaps it would be the time he had it plus the time they had it with those times together.
Right, exactly. Remember that? The idea that you could kind of add your possession time to the next person's possession time. Should we allow adverse possession of chattels? Should it allow tacking? Should we be able to add our kind of time in the same way?
Yeah, I think it becomes, given the nature of chattels, I think it's even more appropriate.
Even more appropriate for tacking?
Move about and move from person to person more easily, especially because they're less expensive, they're not fixed in one place.
Hey, do you guys all agree?
I think just like land, it's just the continuation of ownership, and you're passing that ownership on to somebody else. So I think you should be allowed definitely to do that. I had a question though, is there ever tolling with chattels, or is it only land?
So our next case is our tolling cases. All right, so just to finish up tacking, Jamie, you want to?
Thank you. I think it's more conversion, like separate conversion actions. That so I don't understand why tacking is permitted, but I don't see the reason why it shouldn't be.
So for the most part, it's not. I think logically you guys are right. You know, if we think about the reasons why we have tacking and we think about the reasons we have these short statute of limitations, it makes sense to kind of allow people to add those times together. But for the most part, for adverse possession of stock, of adverse possession of personal property, we start the clock fresh with each new owner. And part of this is I guess the justification generally given for this is we think that that makes it easier, gives the true owner a little bit better opportunity to try and find their stuff. right? If it's going to like switch hands a bunch of times and before it settles down and is in one place, let's say it's just kind of sold and resold a lot in the first year, and it's really hard for the landowner to kind of look around for it. We need it to be kind of settled in one place for a little bit before somebody can get it. My stepmom, when her mother died, some people broke into the house and stole these like very valuable, weird medieval like lutes, like instruments, like they're weird guitars and lutes and stuff like that. And for the first year, they couldn't figure out where they were. And then about a year later, guess where they showed up? eBay, yeah. They all showed up on eBay, but it took some, there's always kind of this initial time that the stuff kind of moves around a little bit. So I guess there's this feeling that if we if we start the clock fresh with each new owner, somehow that's going to help find it.
With the element of actual with chattels, is it the same as land, like using it in a way that an owner would use it?
Yes.
But then open and notorious, it's like they're using it, but as long as they are in no way, like,
so the
stealing?
Yes, exactly. So it, once you get to kind of personal property, the open and notorious standard can look very similar to the actual standard because you're using it in a way that an owner would. And so you think of it more as being what we really want to look for open and notorious is actual concealment. Now what we see in the next case, though, is that open and notorious could be one element, but it might not be the same as when we start the clock for taking the statute of limitations. I know you guys will be shocked to learn that the person whose name I have down to discuss the next case is not here. Right? Allie, you're not hiding somewhere? Right? It's amazing. Oh my God. I mean, like, I feel like I should be able to somehow make money off of this talent. Who else was into painting? There was somebody else who was. Man, I shouldn't even do this. I'm just going to pick somebody randomly, which I hate to do, because I like to be thoughtful about it. Francis, can you help us?
Sure.
All right. Georgia O'Keeffe, have you heard of her?
Sort of.
Other people heard of Georgia O'Keeffe?
Yeah.
Oh, man, last year nobody had heard of Georgia O'Keeffe. I nearly cried. All right. All right, what's going on with Georgia O'Keeffe?
She alleged that paintings were stolen from her art gallery, and that 30 years later she found or learned out where the paintings were, and alleged that they should be returned to her, meaning that they were stolen, and it was to be stolen, she didn't have the right to resell them, she didn't have the right to obtain the title of them.
All right, absolutely. So Georgia O'Keeffe, famous artist. All right, there's these pictures are dark. She has these pictures stolen from her in what year?
46.
Like 46, somewhere around there, from her husband, from a gallery that her husband owned. Why did she not report the theft?
They're uninsured, and there's an attitude that they won't be recovered regardless.
She feels like there's not really point to you know, it's not going to help anything. Her husband, as we know, dies just like a year later. She's worried this is just going to upset things. She also says, it just wouldn't have been my way. I don't know. Right? They also, I will say, at that time, are not as valuable as they are today. Right? So she does not report them originally when they are stolen. Here, you can't even see those pictures, they're so dark. That's an old picture of Georgia O'Keeffe when she's older and a picture of her husband, who is also, people heard of Stiglitz? One, two, okay. All right, famous photographer. So this is like the power couple of the art world. And these are the paintings that are, these are two of the paintings that were actually stolen. allegedly or whatever. All right, okay. So it's 1946 when they're stolen. When does she report the theft?
She discusses it with people, but doesn't actually report theft until
72. But you're right. She talks about it with a couple people. She mentions it in passing. She tells her dealer, her art dealer. And then in 75 is when Barry Snyder buys the painting. Let's see, what year does she sue? 76, right? All right, she's what type of action is she bringing? Replevin or Trover?
Replevin.
She wants the paintings back. Now we hear, see where Replevin works, right? Like, and we can see why. She really wants the paintings more than the money. She has a lot of money at this point. Okay. All right, let's go through the elements of adverse possession. Actual possession?
Well, I mean,
purchased them, so he owns them now. He owns the gallery.
Right, so he has possession of these paintings. He's acting with using them like a owner would, looking at them, potentially selling them, that type of thing. Exclusive?
They're in his gallery.
They're in his gallery. He's not sharing them. It's not like she gets them every other month or something. Is this open and notorious?
They're on display. So.
Very much different than the violin, right? This is actually open on display. People come into this gallery. It's like the sales reported in the newspaper, right? This is like kind of a much more easy for us to feel like open and notorious is met here. Hostile?
I mean, he's using them openly. So.
He's claiming ownership. He's claiming that they're his. He's not suggesting that they're hanging in his gallery with permission of the artist or something like that. Continues for the statutory period.
That's because there's an issue when we have a discussion of discovery of the item itself, where the statute of limitations starts from the date of loss.
Exactly. All right, so now we see something. If we were to kind of think about this, like from the point that she lost it, that was a really long time ago. If we were to think about it from the point of when Ulrich, right? Ulrich is who Snyder buys it from. If we were to think about it from the standpoint of like how long Ulrich had it, that was sure a long time ago. His family had it for more than 6 years. But what we change here is we acknowledge that those are open and notorious, but we're going to change when we're going to start the counting of that statute of limitations. We feel like we should treat personal property differently when it comes to counting for our clock for the statute of limitations. All right, Francis, when should we start counting?
The discussion is between when it gets lost and when the person has the opportunity to discover it. Given the fact that she's been actively searching for them, when she finally does discover them, that's when the 6 years should start for her to initiate action.
This court adopts something that they call the discovery rule. The statute of limitations does not begin to run until the true owner knows, or by exercise of reasonable diligence should have known, facts that form the basis of the cause of action. So it's not actually getting at the other elements. It's just getting at the statute of limitations and how we're going to start that, how we're going to do that clock. This is tolling, right? This is the idea of tolling. This is the idea is that we do not think it's fair to start the clock. In the way with adverse possession of real property, we say we don't think it's fair to start the clock on a 6-year-old. Here we say we don't think it's fair to start the clock on a person who could not have figured out where their thing was. So we're going to create this standard in New Jersey that's the discovery rule, and other states have adopted it, the discovery rule that says at the point that you discovered where your property was or should have discovered by reasonable diligence where your property is, that's when you're going to start the clock. Francis, when do you think we probably should start the clock here?
Given that she never reported them stolen, it's kind of an issue, but she did openly discuss them being stolen, so... I think the fact that they're in somebody's home at the time and on display, there's obviously no way for her to gain knowledge of that barn and be invited to a party at the right house.
Yeah.
Of where her paintings are. And when there is some public policy that said that the art recovery, what is it called?
The Art Recurs
Association was trying to recover stolen paintings. The registry didn't exist until 1972, but she did actively try to start for it. I would. Even if it's something.
That you would have started it maybe, you said 70, you would feel like she acted diligently?
She did the entire time in a sense, and then when she had an opportunity to really do something about it that was, you know, from a different. Avenue she did, but it's hard to punish her for.
Well, so it's tricky though, right? So this is the question, is like whether or not we could, if we just did it by when she discovered, we see that that happens in like 75 or 76. And she brings suit right away. So if we start the clock by when she discovered it, she's brought suit immediately. She's fine. If we think instead about when she should have, using due diligence, discovered it, it becomes a tricky question. It's not clear to me she would have met that standard. The court never actually engages in that. They remand it to say, this is the new standard we're adopting in New Jersey. We're adopting the discovery rule. We're going to remand for you to figure out when that clock should have started based on the discovery rule. On remand, do you guys see what happened? technically settled. So we never actually do have an inquiry into whether she met the discovery rule or not. The parties settle. I don't remember what they do. They split them up or something. This case is just like mentioned in one line in your book. I thought I would just give it to you because it is the New York approach. There was a case in I think this is at the Met. This is like Art Appreciation Day. Anybody identify this artist? Picasso. It's a Chagall. It's a clear Chagall. Oh, you had it nice. I didn't hear you. All right. Anyways, this is a little Chagall painting that is stolen by a guy who works in the mailroom at the Met. And the Met does not report its sale very strategically, not because they're not being diligent, because they are worried that reporting and advertising they're worried that reporting and advertising the theft will actually drive the piece underground and will only be kind of bought and sold in kind of shady, dark corners of the art world. And so they said, we're going to sit on our hands and see if it shows up on eBay or the equivalent. Right? And so, and this is why actually New York's rule, which is very favorable to artists, it's called the demand and refusal rule. This is the approach that gives the true owner the best opportunity to get their object back. The demand and the refusal rule gives the greatest protection. Under this approach, the statute of limitations does not begin until the original owner asks for the property and is refused. See how different that is than even the discovery rule. The discovery rule requires some type of diligence on the part of the landowner, the property owner. In the demand and refusal rule, you could kind of be sitting back and not doing anything for 20 years, and then you see somebody walks into the classroom wearing your grandma's earrings, and you're like, I want those back. They're like, they've been mine for 20 years. Too bad, man. Demand and refusal rule. Clock starts now. So we have kind of one of the more generous rules for the property owner getting their things back. All right, we will start with gifts next time. They are fun. I don't mean I'm bringing them. I will see who I can try and call on.